Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So, talk just a little bit for me, Chris.
What? My name is Chris. I am the best ever.
You really can drop a fat beat.
Yeah, man.
I just wanted to make sure you were coming through. And like I said, I got Elijah kind of closer. He's got that deep.
He's got that raspy.
Yeah, he's got that. I'm bringing the point. I don't think you were here for the Elijah has 3 points to all his points.
Oh, no.
That was the best.
Oh, God.
But anyway, so are you good?
Yeah.
And you're good?
I'm good.
All right. Well, then we will get started. So, welcome to Real World Theology, Episode 8. I'm your host, Fizz. On this episode of the show, we take a look at the final installment in Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright's Cornetto, or Blood and Ice Cream trilogy, The World's End. It is a film that sadly ends a series of movies that have, to some degree, redefined comedic genres. Though I am sure we will see more from this team in some form in the future, for now, we take a look back at what these storytellers have been weaving into their narratives since Shaun of the Dead in 2004, Hot Fuzz in 2007, and now the final product, The World's End. So with me today, with Newcastle's in hand, in honor of the pub crawl, our British beer, thanks to Elijah, is Elijah. But I am very ecstatic to have them back. Let's see. We all know Elijah by now, Elijah Lovejoy, community pastor at Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro. But joining him is newcomer to the show, comic connoisseur, home repair specialist, and all-around nice guy, Chris Merriweather.
Wow.
So what's up, gentlemen?
Happy to be here.
Yeah, that's quite an introduction.
Well, you told me just to write whatever because you didn't want to write one on your own, man. So that's what you get.
Yeah.
So everyone gets one last, one introductory swig of their Newcastle.
Fantastic.
Which I, for any beer connoisseurs, I'm sure is not the best British beer we could have, but
it's the one and only.
It's affordable and it tastes pretty good.
This also helps you stick around to the end of the show because we are tracing the pub crawl as we review the pub crawl. So the end of the show is going to be the best part of the whole show.
Last time we did the 12 pub Newcastle crawl, Elijah only made it to 8, and we're hoping he can make it further.
That's right.
So the beauty of this movie is that there is a ton to talk about, which is weird because we actually talked a little earlier about how some of the blockbusters have a couple themes, but they usually aren't as deep as some of the lesser seen movies. And the writing is so good in this Cornetto trilogy, and the writers know exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So they have not left us empty. Mm-hmm. So without further hesitation, I'd love to have time to talk about the entire trilogy, but I know it's impossible. Fortunately, having the same writer, Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, we do see a lot of the same themes, so I know we'll have a chance to bring them all in at some point. So since we're focusing on the latest film, let's get to it. The World's End is a movie about 5 friends who reunite in an attempt to top their epic pub crawl from 20 years earlier and unwittingly become humankind's only hope for survival. It stars Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, Bilbo Baggins, or Watson, depending on what flavor of Martin Freeman you prefer, a host of others from their TV show, Spaced, and Shaun of the Dead, and Hot Fuzz. So, we always start a little less theology, a little more critic. Chris.
Yes.
Did you enjoy this film?
I certainly did enjoy the film. As I was going into it, I was searching deep inside my soul, trying to figure out whether I could watch it without comparing it to one of my all-time favorite movies, Hot Fuzz.
And how many times have you seen Hot Fuzz?
That's my go-to movie when people come over. I'm like, have you seen Hot Fuzz? And so I've really probably in the last 2 months I've watched it several times. So
much to the chagrin of your wife?
No, she likes it too. I mean, this is like a gem in every way, in my opinion.
Are you sure your wife's not the gem?
Maybe, yes, that also is true.
So you had high expectations going into Worlds.
Very high expectations, and I wanted to enjoy it in its own right. But since it's part of a trilogy and all these other things, it's really hard for me not to compare them. So I did enjoy it, yes, but alas, it does not... It didn't meet all of the expectations that I had placed upon it. Obviously, I enjoyed it, but
was it as good as Hot Fuzz?
It was not as good as Hot Fuzz in my
opinion. You enjoy it more than Shaun of the Dead?
I did enjoy Shaun. I enjoyed this more than I enjoyed Shaun of the Dead.
So in your rankings, just to be clear, on the bottom, Shaun of the Dead,
World's End,
Hot Fuzz
cannot be topped in my opinion.
But you're still giving it like...
It is a good. I would give it an 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10.
Yeah.
So a 4 out of 5 stars.
A 4 out of 5 also.
For all you mathematicians.
Yes, if you know the math.
All right, Elijah.
I actually didn't enjoy it a whole lot after I saw it the first time. And then I went back and saw it again with Chris yesterday and enjoyed it much more. And I do think this is the best movie of the trilogy. Read a great quote from Simon Pegg. Basically, the quote said, "We had the idea for this movie 6 years ago, but we needed 6 years of life to be able to write this movie." So there's a level of authenticity and maturity to this movie that I think outshines all the other movies. I thought it was profound. I thought it was good. I thought the writing was richer in this movie than any of the other movies. And I thought the plot line was... simple, it's hard to find a movie that's so silly but so deep at the same time. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any other writers that pull that off, to be kind of stupid but profound.
And time after time, because you also enjoy Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
I did. I would rank them in reverse order. So I would rank them World's End, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead.
Okay, from top to bottom.
Top to bottom.
So, okay.
So I would disagree with Chris about...
But just barely.
No, we had a pretty significant disagreement in the car on the way over here.
But Shaun of the Dead's still the intro level.
Yeah. We do agree on that.
Okay. Yes. And I would probably agree. I think they've gotten better as time has gone on. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for me to rank The World's End above Hot Fuzz.
Uh-huh.
Because I like them both fairly well when I saw them the first time. But much kind of like Elijah, you're describing, the second time I watched these films, it almost blew my mind. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, both Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg in some of their interviews, especially about The World's End, talk about like when they're writing, lots of the punchlines are at the beginning of the film. Mm-hmm. Or like in the middle of the film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's not until you've gone through, seen the entire movie, that you realize
true.
How...
That's true.
And I find that especially to be true with The World's End. I feel like The World's End is kind of like the pinnacle of their
That's
writing.
Interesting.
But at the same time... Hot Fuzz, to me, was... I kind of agree with Chris as well. It's a great film, and so I would probably put them neck and neck.
Now that you say that, it makes me totally rethink my grading system, because I did only see The World's End once.
There you go.
So with Hot Fuzz, I've watched it a million times, and every single time I watch it, I appreciate something new about it.
There you go.
And so I only saw The World's End once, so perhaps that is...
You'll love it. 10 times more the
Perhaps
next time.
That
yeah,
is why.
There's so many things that go on in this movie.
I hadn't
like,
thought about it.
At the beginning and in the middle.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you can find it if you want spoilers, but lots in the interview, Simon Pegg talks about mm-hmm. things that you see show up later. You know, he's like, mm-hmm. well, we mentioned this as kind of like this funny thing in the middle,
but then at
the end, that's what happens to this guy.
Right.
So we're almost foreshadowing it and stuff like that.
For example, they get to their first or second pub, and one of the reluctant friends says, "What are we doing here?" And Simon Pegg's character says, "We're here to get annihilated." Get it?
See, Chris is already enjoying it.
Chris's level of enjoyment for the movie just went up.
That was good.
So we all really enjoyed it. That's cool. I would say, you know, there was anytime you have a trilogy, anytime you have the same guys doing the same thing, mm-hmm. there's always almost like a letdown because your expectations are so high. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few combinations of writers, actors, anyone making movies that I've not been let down at any mm-hmm. part in the thing. So with that said, I think that in and of itself says a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. without going too deep into that, but moving on to specific kind of themes that we've seen, a theme that is seen in all three films, and even though we're not technically talking about all three films, I know we're going to like touch on them, and is the catalyst for this film, is the concept of discontent, discontentment in life. We see a group of guys who have grown up and moved on to various degrees of success, and none of them are very happy, you know? We see even, like you were talking about earlier, simple writing kind of, you know, we see Gary King, our protagonist, to a certain degree. He has never left the past, so we have one in the spectrum, and we have Andy, his best friend, who has gone in the complete opposite direction. He's completely forsaken the past, and neither one of them are happy. You know, so when you think about the three films, do you see this kind of narrative running through all of them, with Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, people who are very unhappy with where they are and they need to get to a new place?
I really see Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg tapping into this idea about the mundaneness of life. If you think about how all three films start, Shaun of the Dead, it's all about just sitting on the couch playing video games. I mean, how much more mundane can you get for just a bunch of guys hanging out playing video games and being mad at each other for not doing the dishes or whatever? Hot Fuzz, the mundane thing is you get sent away to the little country village and you're just sitting there shooting your speedometer over and over again. 29, 28, 27. I mean, just kind of a mundane, boring life. And then the mundane, boring life of World's End is all these guys that are just doing their 9-to-5 and kind of punching the clock and obviously unhappy. One guy's got a divorce. One guy's under his dad's thumb at the car dealership. Another guy, we find out later, he's left his wife. His wife and kids have left him, Andy, at the end of the movie. So they all start off in the same place to me, this place of life is mundane, life is kind of stale or boring. And then they face this major crisis that kind of jars them out of that. Interestingly, I think all the movies go back to the mundane.
Yeah.
They all end at the mundane stage, but with this little tweak that's been thrown in there. So, yeah, I do think that I do think it taps into kind of the ordinariness of life. And kind of asks, how do you get out of that? Do you want to get out of that? And how do you deal with the enjoyments, but also the relational conflicts of that stage of life?
I think it also has something to do with, you know, at the end, it seems like there's, at the beginning of the movie, the mundaneness is kind of forced upon them, but at the end, they all end up kind of choosing that. Mm-hmm. You know, they embrace it and they find purpose in the mundane. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that you talk about happiness and then finding contentment in the mundaneness, because there's been some kind of shift. And it was one of the more telling quotes that I saw in the interviews with Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. Simon Pegg actually says, when he talks kind of about the resolution to their films, he says, what matters is personal happiness. Mm-hmm. And that's the true holy grail of life, finding happiness.
Yeah.
And
he also says, we don't offer any answers.
Yeah, we don't offer any answers, but find happiness.
Yeah. Right.
And happiness is this thing that's painted with such a broad brush that I guess mundaneness can be happy. I mean, where do you land on that argument? Like, is life just about happiness?
It's interesting. We had this debate on our staff team a couple months ago, because if you read St. Augustine, St. Augustine talks about happiness all the time. This is back in mid-400s AD, they called it felicity. They said that the goal of life is eternal felicity, eternal happiness. So the debate became, how do you find that happiness? So they would say you find that happiness through relationship with God and through knowing Him and His work in your life. And so they disagreed with the pagans. The pagans tried to find happiness through going to the theater, through going to having sexual escapades in the temple or whatever. And so the debate was about how you find happiness. And so I would agree with Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright that I think I think the church or Christianity in general has made a mistake today by shying away from happiness and seeing happiness as a selfish thing or a taboo thing. Like, don't talk about happiness because whatever, God might take something away from you and then your faith will fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just silly. And you can still be happy in terms of an eternal happiness, even in the midst of suffering and even in the midst of other things. So I think they're raising a good question, I guess is where I would come down. They're raising a good question. I don't necessarily agree with all their answers, but I appreciate them for raising the question of happiness.
Yeah, and I would say that part of the reason why these movies connect so well with people is because life is full of the mundane. And, you know, obviously we all sit around and play video games and are lazy and, you know,
all of us?
yes, certainly not you.
That's right.
But I mean, sorry, I'll fess up. And, you know, we all experience that, but, you know, I wouldn't say life is all about being happy by any means. I think when I'm watching these movies, I'm thinking more about people who are looking for a purpose and are looking for, you know, a drive in their life, and they find their drive and their purpose and their fulfillment inside of the mundaneness, inside of all these things. So in my mind, I'm using happiness and purpose interchangeably when I'm watching these movies. And, you know, I see people who, you know, in The World's End, they're all at very, you know, you have Gary King and you have all of his friends very successful and the very unsuccessful. All of them are unsatisfied. None of them have purpose. And you know, at the same time, none of them are happy. So,
well, one of the big things I see in that, you see it in Hot Fuzz, you see it especially in The World's End, is this theme of the fight or a fight. And so things are mundane, but the thing that tests your happiness at a deeper level is when life is threatened, essentially. So in World's End, it happens in the bathroom. Like, the bathroom scene with Simon Pegg kind of trying to make small talk with the robot who he doesn't yet know is a robot. Like, what happened right before that scene was the friends were about to split up and go home. Like, everybody was going back to the hotel. The pub crawl was over. And so that was the make or break moment of the first half of the movie. And so the fight is what took it to the next level. And then all the friends come in and then it's an epic fight between robots and pub crawl friends in the bathroom. Same thing happened in a lot of ways too. I think in Hot Fuzz, like, it was the fight that took it to the next level. And I think Shaun of the Dead, I haven't seen Shaun of the Dead in a while, but fighting the zombies was like where you get jarred out of your mundaneness, maybe would be a good way to put it.
Would you say that maybe their idea, and they hit on this in some of the interviews as well, is that growing up is part of becoming happy? I mean, like, we see in Shaun of the Dead, you know, they're agedly adults, but like mentally and like socially, they're still,
right,
you know, it's this concept of extended adolescence or, I guess just wallowing in their adolescence. And in Shaun of the Dead, they have to kind of grow up. Like, something happens. Like, in Shaun of the Dead, they deal with death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Hot Fuzz, they have, like, friendships and trust and almost like a purpose in life kind of discussion. Like, you know, why do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
What's more important? And then in World's End, they kind of have to die to the idea of running from the past. They either have to, like, allow the past to be the past and realize that it kind of shaped them into what they are, or leave the past and realize that they still have to live in the present. I mean, Edgar Wright even said that Gary King's first step to actually making some kind of progression is to reject his younger self. When he gets a chance to be in his younger body, he literally kills himself. So it's actually the first act of growing up. Him doing that is like, actually, I don't want the teenage me. I want to be me. You know.
Yeah.
So like, there's a progression. I mean, like, do we see like a call to maturity from these films?
Well, I'll say my favorite line in the whole movie was where they're talking about. What's the name of the friend who went to the bathroom and got replaced by a robot?
Let's just call him Martin Freeman.
Yeah. Okay. So Martin Peter, it was Peter, wasn't it?
Was it Peter?
I think it was.
No, Peter's the guy whose name you stole.
Okay.
Nothing the internet can't solve.
Martin Freeman's character. So he comes back from the bathroom, or he's in the bathroom, and they're talking about him. And they say, he's a man. And they say, no, he's a baby. And they say, no, he's a maybe. And, like, it's a perfect line to encapsulate, I think, what you're talking about. Kind of a man child or a man baby or an adult who's still in adolescence. And then they call him a maybe. And I think the maybe is a word for, like, you don't really know where they stand. Yeah. They're like...
It's not just clever.
It's not just, like, a double combining of the two words. It's meant to be a synopsis of their character. Like, they're not... fully developed. They're just a maybe. And so I think that's, I do think that's a big theme in the movie. I also think where he kills himself, Simon Pegg's character kills himself.
Well, and just in case it wasn't clear, like with every podcast, spoiler alert to anyone who's listening, we're going to talk about the movie from start to finish.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So there's a huge Christian theme here that just kind of hit me. And that is, we are called by Christ and through Christ's death and resurrection, we are called to die with Christ. So what the network was trying to do to the humans, Christ is trying to do to us. The difference is...
That sounds awful.
I don't know about that. Now that scares me.
Hold on, stick with him.
Yeah, okay.
No, this is true. So that was my provocative statement. So we are called to die with Christ. Like, there's no other way to enter life than to die and rise with Christ. The difference between Jesus and the network is that Jesus raises us back to life, not as robots, but as ourselves, as our redeemed selves, essentially, as who he created us to be with his life in us. So he doesn't replace us with empty heads and blue paint. He replaces us with the life of the Holy Spirit. So it's interesting, they both come to the same conclusion about how to address the problem. You've got to die. That's what Jesus says. Unless you take up your cross and follow me and die with me, essentially, you're not worthy to be my disciple. But they come to different conclusions about how, what redemption looks like. So for the network, redemption looks like replacing everybody who resists with blue paint robots. But with Christ, redemption looks like being made new, being made who you were supposed to be in the first place. Still your full body, flesh and blood, soul, personality, but redeemed by the Holy Spirit living inside you.
Do you think in making this movie, how closely do you think they were, you know, trying to get you to think that?
I don't think they were. I mean, I don't know them. I don't know their spiritual background, but I do think this exact same theme exists in Hot Fuzz. So the goal of Hot Fuzz is to kill the resistors, to kill those who bring shame to the town. Mm. So the graveyard is full of dead people. It's the exact same theme that the network is doing with World's End.
And to be fair, living statues are pretty atrocious.
That's true. He had it coming. He was asking for it.
Yeah.
Well, what you're saying reminds me a lot of, if you go back to Lord of the Rings, it's that scene where Gandalf finally comes back and it's like, oh, is it Saruman? He's like, it is Saruman. Or Saruman as he should have been.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, when you're talking about being replaced by not an imposter, but people as their true selves. Mm-hmm. Or as the purest versions of themselves. But, So Chris, when you're watching The World's End, even though you've only seen it one time.
Only one time.
It's
terrible.
like what scenes are like really grabbing you? Like what's really doing it for you, or what's kind of sticking, what stuck with you?
Scenes that stuck with me. I would definitely say in the beginning, it is stuck in my mind several times, in the bathroom scene where they first discover the robots.
Flip the switch.
Yeah. And
which
not
one?
Simon Pegg, the other guy, the big dude.
Andy.
Yeah.
Who was a boss in this movie. It was so cool to see these action scenes. But
Chuck stools.
But after oh no, it was when they came in and Simon Pegg, Greg was on the ground and he had the robot and he's like, you lied about your mom, you know? And it's like, how backseat the fact that he's got this headless blue bleeding thing in his arms was to, like, you lied about your mom.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but that's really stuck in my mind a lot. Huh. It's completely outrageous, obviously, but I don't know why that stuck with me so much. And so, you know, just like in Hot Fuzz and in Shaun of the Dead, there's like this undercurrent of relationship between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost's characters. Yeah. And that fascinates me so much.
Well, I mean, that was the process of going from the former scene, like, I hate you, I'm going to leave you, you're a liar, you stole from your friends just to pay me back, to, oh my goodness, you're actually my friend and you're in trouble. And you just got almost beat up by a robot. And I actually see that theme intensifying over the movie. So at first, Gary just gets them together and basically manipulates them all to being together for a pub crawl. He lies to all of them, gets them together, and they don't even want to be there. And then they get attacked, and they actually all want to be there. They still don't like Gary, but they want to be there to, I mean, they know they have to be there for their own survival. So they say, let's just go through with this, act the part. And then so that's a shift. They go from not wanting to be there to actually wanting to fight. And then the second shift happens where they actually want to fight for each other.
Yeah.
So true. Like when, and I know you're going to get to this part in a little bit, but at the end when the network's just lambasting Gary and Andy is standing over to the side, just like, I hate my friend. He tried to do 12 pubs and is going to get us all killed. And then he steps up and says, wait a minute. So that's like the final shift of the fight. It's like, I'm now going to fight for my friend Gary. And so I think that's the progression of the movie from, I never want to see you again, you ruined my life 20 years ago, to now I'm going to fight for you in the present.
And in kind of a concept of still having to accept the past versus running from the past, you know, they have to kind of meet in the middle. Mm-hmm. Gary has to realize that Gary King, the one and only, has to realize that, you know, he's got a present life to live. And Andy has to realize that there was some value in where he's come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's another huge theme of the movie that dovetails into that. So it's the theme of messiness. So they remember they get pulled over by the cop.
Yeah.
And they say, Gary King says, things are going to get a little messy. And the cop says, don't let things get too messy. That's his final word. And then he comes up to him at one of the pubs and says, things gotten messy yet?
Yeah.
And it comes up several other times. The biggest time it comes up, though, is when they're in like one of the final pubs and they're not sure if Gary is a robot, if he's been replaced by a robot. And so what they're doing is they're calling back stories from their childhood and they're saying, show me your scar. And when one of them pulls off a scar, pulls up a sleeve and shows a scar, everybody breathes a sigh of relief. Like, thank goodness, like, you're human.
Except for when the dude shows his butt. You don't breathe a sigh of relief.
No, even then, it's like, oh, that's pretty good. Like, one of them makes...
oh, yeah, you thought it was good.
One of them makes a comment and says, hey, like, every scar brings a sigh of relief. And I think the scar represents the past, it represents pain, and it represents messiness. But it's this theme of humanity, that if you have scars, you're proving to me that you're real, and you're not a robot. If you don't have scars, I don't trust you, and I'm going to try to kill you.
So does that mean, since Gary had scars that he was unwilling to show, he had to kind of meet them where they were because he had to create new scars with him? Because, you know, he bashed his head into a pole until he started bleeding.
Right.
Instead of showing him the scars that he already had, like, he had to...
I don't understand why he didn't want to show the scars.
Yeah,
I don't know if we want to wait for our... You know, that disappointed me, to see the resolution of, like, to see the relationship develop between these two characters, which for me is what I think I almost appreciate that most in all the three movies. I didn't see that really develop at the end, at the pivotal moments. I didn't fully understand exactly what was happening, honestly. I mean, I get
In which part? The scar part?
The scar part, as they're fighting over the, you know, you can't have the beer part. The whole kind of climactic relationship parts didn't really sink for me. And so I don't know why.
Well, and even at the end, he's lost track of Gary. Like, they're not even friends anymore.
Yeah.
Like, Gary's off leading a band of robots, and Andy's been reunited to his wife, and they're doing an organic garden together.
That's true.
Oh, and they'll never know how much they actually meant to each other, because they don't get to see each other. Like, and Andy's really appreciative of his friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he will never tell him.
Well, and isn't this a way of, isn't this though a fitting end to the trilogy? Mm-hmm. Like, they're saying this is life. Like,
yeah.
One of the quotes of the interviews that they did said, when we haven't seen somebody, I said, we got together, like, did a 20-year high school reunion, and we all told stories and realized that all we had was in the past, and we've never spoken again. Like, I think Edgar Wright is the one that said, if you haven't seen somebody in 10 years, then it's time to move on. Like, that's just life, and how rare it is to have friendships that actually keep going and continue. So they were okay with this idea of friendships dying or parting, or they had a time, and now they don't exist anymore. I mean, that's part of life to them.
Hmm. Well, I did think of something while you were talking, and I guess it's not going to be as poignant as what you just said, so I almost feel like I'm digressing. But I think I just realized that if I would have seen the movie for three times,
good for you.
That I think the reason he didn't want to show his scar is because he would have had to pull up his sleeve where he had his bandages.
He would have had to show his bandages. Because
he tried to kill himself.
Yeah.
He wasn't an AA.
And that's why I was like, is he saying he tried to kill himself?
Yeah, he tried to kill. That's why he was there. He tried to kill himself. Oh, the door's just open.
Well, like, he was in an AA because of alcohol, right?
Well, he was in AA because he was in some kind of self-help group.
They told me when to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Right. So that's more than just AA.
It was a psychiatric ward.
I got you.
So I was, they hinted, but they did not.
He wasn't ready to go there yet.
Well, which is why at the end, when he's fighting with Andy, trying to finish the pub crawl.
Yeah.
He's like, I've got to do this. It's all I have.
This is all I've got. Yeah.
You know, and he's like, it's not. And then he sees his wrist and he's already tried to kill himself, which is why I think that quote from Edgar Wright that I was talking about earlier is even more pivotal than I think most people would think, because he said, not only does he reject his younger self, but he has to actually finally kill himself, something that he had been trying to do.
Yeah.
And what he was really trying to do was kill his younger self so he could live with his current self.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I think there are, 1,000 applications of this in our own lives. You know, I wish I didn't do this. I wish I could get rid of that thing, that one thing that I did, or who I was. And, and I mean, we can, I think, logically take this to the next step of, you know, that's what we get kind of with the Christian life. We have to, like, let our old self die.
Yeah.
And it's something that's desirable. Most people want to forget about parts of their life, and, but it makes us who we are. So we can't forget it. But we have to not let it control who we are today.
Yeah.
So, how is the movie depicting Gary King's redemption? So he reaches the breaking point. He rebels against the network, and Andy fights with him. He says, "This is all I've got." So he kind of finishes the pub crawl. The last scene you get of Gary King is he's leading a band of robots drink, and they're all drinking waters together, and they're all about to fight a bunch of humans. So, what are the writers saying that Gary King found after that kind of crisis with the pub crawl and with Andy and with his friends? Like, I'm guessing they're saying he matured in some way, but he's kind of gone back to adolescence at the same time.
But that's how all the movies are. I mean, you know, you grow, but not in the way that you would have expected. In a way, you're embracing
your childish. They go back to the mundane thing. Yeah, he's playing video games with a zombie again.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take a stab at this.
Okay.
I think that Gary finds his mundane by getting what he thought he was going to get, by giving up what he thought he had.
Hmm.
All right. He ends up at the end of the movie basically still being Gary King, hanging out with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
The younger selves, like the robot selves are eternally the younger selves. And that's why he got the guys back together. He thought those guys were the same guys, but they weren't his friends anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were to some degree, but they weren't the friends he knew. So he ends the movie by realizing that he couldn't be totally who he was in the past. And he kills his younger self symbolically, you know, metaphorically and actually, you know, viscerally on the screen.
Right.
But then still find something to fight for outside of Gary King.
Mm-hmm.
So he ends up fighting for the things, and the drinking of water proves that he doesn't need something right. to anesthetize right, the right. present.
He has grown up in that way.
Yeah.
And he never actually got his drink. You know, that to never, me is like, you know, well, he pulls the lever and then the and it's like, you never actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that he's leading robots. So, I mean, I'm almost wondering, is this kind of caring for the outcasts almost? Like, these are the rejects of society now, the rebooted robots. And he's kind of put together another band of misfits almost.
He has purpose.
And right. yeah, it is. It's giving him purpose to lead robots and to fight humans.
Yeah, I didn't really know what to think of that.
Now,
like,
now Chris is going to see the movie again.
Yeah, well, clearly, at least once.
Well, and one guy, one of the humans in the final pub, asks him, "Who are you?" And I forget his exact response, but it's kind of like one of those moments, like, "You're a new man. Are you like Robin Hood or something?" Or
King Arthur.
King Arthur. Yeah, you come back with your sword. Yeah.
Enumus.
Yeah, it's a lion.
Oh yeah, that was
amazing.
Good line. Here's something I really like too, is how the network, kind of artificial intelligence, grows and learns, tries to make happiness more and more appealing and less robotic.
Right.
So they go to the first pub, and it's, "Tell me about the beer. Is it fruity? Is it nutty? Is it spicy?"
Yeah.
"It's bitter." Like, the robot only has one word to describe the beer, and it's bitter. And so then they get to, like, one of the second or third to last pubs, and the robot has a big smile on his face, and he's regurgitating the exact words that he asked at the first pub. "Would you like a fruity, nutty, spicy beer?" And then he's smiling and waving at him all the time. And then you get to the nightclub, and yes. Gary King says, "Oh, this is where it's at." Like, he thinks he's found real happiness. Like, oh, yeah. Finally... this is the real deal here. People are dancing, nightclub, techno music, all this stuff, and kissing the schoolgirls and
the schoolgirls.
And it actually works. Like, he would have stayed there if the girl and Steve, what was Steve's girl? I can't remember her name.
Oh wait.
If they hadn't come and like rescued him, and that's probably how they made his younger self, is through getting his DNA through the kissing.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, like, he would have fallen. So the network got smarter, and in a sense, it outsmarted him by the time the nightclub came around about letting him, giving him the happiness that he thought he really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
How did he even get out of that? I'm trying to recall.
They said these are flats, or these are blanks, and said, "Don't be judgmental." That's when he like tried to defend their robots because they were calling. He's calling the girl he was kissing a blank. That was a good line.
I just love them. It's getting into stuff we'll talk about later, but just some of the conversations they had.
My favorite line was like, "WTF? Does WTF mean?"
Yeah,
that absolutely killed me.
Yeah,
oh, man, that was funny.
And that was probably another man baby thing. Like the guy, Martin Freeman's character,
Oliver,
like. All he says the whole movie is, "WTF, Gary? WTF?" Like, he's kind of critiquing his acronym.
Yeah.
Well, I think ultimately this movie leads us to the final conversation that Gary King, the one and only, has with the
Uncle
network.
Rico.
Yeah, with Uncle Rico, with the network. Did you pick that up too? It was Bill Nye. The network was Bill Nye.
What?
No, I didn't. That was his voice?
Yeah.
Huh. No way.
He was in all of them, man.
Bill Nye?
Bill Nye.
Oh,
you know, like
Inspector. Not the science guy.
Yeah, no.
I thought he was the guy in the other movies, right?
Yeah.
Bill Nye. That's so random.
Nye, I guess. So what it does, it leads us ultimately through all these relationships to the pit of the world's end.
Mm-hmm.
Gary King's having this conversation with the network. The network reveals that it's actually working for the good of humankind. It's trying to prep them for the intergalactic stage. They're almost ready. Humans have potential, but they just need a little push. Mm-hmm. And the network's here only helping. And Gary says, we don't, you know, we're humans. It's our right to F up, to to drink and have fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to mess up. And that's who humans are. So just leave us alone. Mm-hmm. And so we come to this fundamental concept of what I guess Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright are telling us they believe freedom is. So, and we talked earlier about how Gary King was not in AA necessarily, but in psychiatric help. But one kind of quote idea that I found, which I thought summed it up nice, was that Gary King fights against the network, which is like an intergalactic AA for Earth, asking humans to give up control of ourselves to a higher being. It offers everlasting life to some degree, but comes at the price of being a boring replica. And so if this isn't a metaphor for what most people think of religion or the church, I mean, it's hard to believe. We, you know, Chris asked, you asked Elijah before, you know, how intentional do you think some of those things were?
Yeah.
How intentional do you think that this is? Because this seems...
It seemed pretty outright to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're there saying... In my mind, they're embracing sort of their sin nature, is how I saw it. It's like, you know, who put you in charge?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm free to do whatever the heck I want to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's bad and terrible and I drink and I've wasted my life and all these things, but that's part of being human. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't take that away from me.
That song came on in the car. I'm free to do what I want any old time when they're driving to Newtown.
Free
to do what I want.
Yeah.
I mean, exact words.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, like, where do you think their concept of freedom lands? Like, is it hollow? Is that part of that happiness that they're talking about?
I can't help. When, for some reason, well... I wish it didn't pop up into my head, but when I saw that, I think of this whole kind of current Miley Cyrus, you know, kind of thing. You know, she's all in the news, and it's like, oh my gosh, she's so, like, scandalous and all these things. And in my mind, I see this movie saying, like, well, you know what? Like, it's embracing this sort of, like, Miley Cyrus attitude of, well, I can do whatever I want, you know? It's my house. I can do what I want to. Kind of attitude, you know, it's my freedom, don't tell me what to do, you know, network / God. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I saw that final sort of encounter.
Well, it's interesting to me, like, the friends and the network, in a sense, had the same goal. Like, the friends kept on trying to intervene in Gary's life, and the network kept on trying to intervene in Gary's life. Like, they had different means and they had different levels of care. So the friends really loved him and really cared for him. The network didn't really love him. Like, he was just a little monkey wrench in their kind of super galactic goal. So I guess in that sense, the question, who are you to tell me, is, I don't think, directed against anybody telling him to do anything. Because he didn't say that to the friends. Who are you to tell me not to finish my pub crawl?
Yeah.
So I don't think he was rejecting authority or accountability outright. But I do think, I would agree with you that there's a general, big word, licentiousness, or just kind of loose attitude towards morality. The phrase that captures this for me is the, when you hear people say you only live once, and usually what they mean when they say you only live once, or the way the Bible puts it as far back as Moses' time, is, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So if you only live once, then you should eat and drink, because, or you should get as much freedom and pleasure and experience and bucket list items in as possible. Because that's just kind of the end of it. And if you didn't get the experience, then you're not going to get a chance to have the experience once you die. But So what I would actually dispute is I would dispute the premise that you only live once. I think you actually live twice, because I think Jesus has illustrated and proven the inevitability of resurrection. And so if you live twice, it does raise questions about the second life and how what the relationship is between the first life and the second life. And if you actually do live twice, then maybe you should rethink some of the conclusions you came to when you thought you only lived once. And maybe you would come to different conclusions if you realized that you lived twice and the second life is much more significant, actually, than the first life.
Well, it reminds me a lot of when we talk about the concept of freedom, the, you know, the antithesis of freedom is slavery.
Robot,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and especially with them, like, they don't have... It seems like their worldview doesn't make room for a concept of slavery as a positive thing.
Huh.
And I know that's like, I mean, there's my provocative statement.
Yeah.
But I think that's what the New Testament does. I think that's specifically what Romans does a lot of times. Because in Romans 6 it talks about, but now that you have been set free from sin and have become slaves of God, the fruit you get leads to sanctification and in its end, eternal life.
Hmm.
I mean, so if we believe the beginning of the book of Romans, then we see that everyone is a slave to something.
Right.
And so when they're talking about, hey, I want to be free, man. I want to be free to do this and this. All they're doing is listening to things that they're slave to. They're slave to feeling good in the moment, or they're a slave to their past, or they're a slave to, you know, being, you know, Gary King was obviously a slave to being drunk. You know, because even Andy says, like, if you're drunk all the time, how do you know when you're sober?
Right.
You know, so conceptually, like, how do you work that out in Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright's worldview? Like, do they have any room for slavery to be a positive thing? Do you think even, like, freedom, or do you think they would even conceptually agree that we're all slaves to something?
I think it's so hard to talk about redemption without redemption seeming like a cookie cutter deal. In other words, how do you have a good freedom how do you be a slave in a good way that leads to eternal life and not just have it be white picket fences and daffodils popping up and the sunshine rising perfectly in the upper left-hand corner of your picture every time kind of thing. And so for a movie maker needs conflict, they need friction, they need drama, they need scars, they need unresolved tension. And so in some ways, I think it can be a little bit of an indictment of the church. Like, we try to present, like, here's the package of how you live a good life, live a free life, live a life of a slave to Christ. And I think sometimes we take some of the scars out of it, or we take some of the messiness out of it, and we make it look too good and too easy, and then it just turns people off. So I think the reason they don't like the network is because the network just makes it's just a cookie cutter thing. Let's just...
Makes it sound like a set of rules.
Yeah, a set of rules. Let's kill you, let's replace you with a blue robot, and then you can do whatever you want because we'll control you anyway. And so the difference, I think, the reason we should trust God and not trust the network is because God's demonstrated his character vastly differently and much more lovingly and much more sacrificially through the stories of scripture than the network has. Like, what has the network done to sacrifice for you besides mulch you? They haven't done anything to sacrifice for you. Whereas God has first put his own son through what he's asking us to now go through, which is death and resurrection.
Well, like, before you were a Christian, Chris, like, could you say that your impressions of what was being described as the Christian life, like, does that match up? Like, oh, I get eternal life, but all eternal life means is that I'm going to look and act like everyone else?
Well, I was like 7.
Yeah.
So I don't even remember.
You were like, I
don't know what I had for lunch yesterday, but, yeah, I think that's definitely something I had to work through, was getting past the cookie cutter sort of thing to, you know, really there's a richness and a fullness that the cookie cutter thing doesn't even approach. You know, salvation isn't, you know, buying fire insurance against hell. You know, it's a lot more than that.
Well, when you I guess take it to a more recent application, you know, because I know you've worked with like a lot of youth, high schoolers, doing like Young Life type stuff. I mean, like, are they coming to you with like the same thing? Like, why would I want to? Like, do you even get to have those conversations?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's you know, and walking through the process with them, and I see it in these guys all the time. They have this cookie cutter understanding of what salvation is, and it's, you know, it is, and that is not what brings people to Jesus, you know, because it's not real. It's not, it's hollow. There isn't richness or fullness or purpose or life in it. And so, and I guess by the grace of God, somehow they get, even with that kind of hollow, shallow understanding, they get pulled towards Jesus, and these pivotal moments where they kind of, you see the light turn on, and I guess that's a God thing, but they're like, oh wow, there's a lot more to it than that. And this is something that I would choose for myself to be to sacrifice my life for, to, you know, to be a slave or so on and so forth. And, I mean, in my mind, in the movie, you see them, clearly the network, bad deal, you know, not good, even as enticing as they try to portray it, you know, as the movie progresses, it gets, you know, more and more enticing, and they don't choose the network. Clearly that would be a mistake. You know, it's a bad deal. That's not something you would choose for yourself, but salvation and, you know, Jesus' sacrifice and this purpose and fulfillment and relationship that we have restored is something that we would want to choose for ourselves, you know? Like, I can see them in the movie kind of trying to imitate this kind of thing, but they miss it, obviously, by a little, but it ends up being a lot.
I think a good parallel to, like, the friendship, the pub crawl, or whatever the journey or the adventure is, would be Jesus and the 12 disciples. And I think the gospel writers go out of their way to show the messiness of the disciples' lives.
One pub per gospel.
One pub per gospel.
Per disciple.
Per disciple, yeah. So you have, they doubt, they rebuke Jesus when he's talking to the woman at the well. Jesus, what are you doing here? Tell Jesus to shoo the crowd away when there's 5,000 people who haven't been fed. Peter says, I'll die for you, Jesus. And then that same night, basically he denies him three times before the rooster crows. So, I mean, the disciples come out looking very messy in the gospels. And I think that's very intentional. Number one, it's true. We are all messy. But number two, here's my 3 points of the sub point.
I knew we'd get to it.
But number two, like, people need to see that Peter, who's called the rock on whom the church is built, denied Jesus three times. Like, that should give hope to us. And I think one of the greatest miracles of the gospel and of the church that I see is that God actually works through us, the broken, messy people who whatever word you want to use all the time for messing up. didn't want to use one of the
We're
world.
We're effing it up.
Yeah.
Effing it up,
yes. Who F up all the time. He uses us to build his kingdom and to love people and to love our wives or our friends or husbands, whoever we're with. The fact that he doesn't destroy us, but puts our sin to death and then brings us back to life through his Holy Spirit living in us. The fact that he can do that and work with us is, I think, one of the greatest miracles of the gospel.
And crickets.
We've left
literally
out
crickets.
We've left
yeah,
out right
literally.
Outside.
I don't know if Mike will pick them up, but yeah. It was funny. There was a cricket that hit right before that.
We left out a phrase that we haven't talked about, starbucking yet.
Yeah.
Starbucking.
I love that. Stop starbucking us. Yeah. All the pubs are the exact same. Hey, stop starbucking us.
I mean, that was pretty... in-your-face anti-corporatism. I mean,
absolutely.
That's basically making Starbucks analogous to the network.
Yeah.
Is what they were doing.
And the network, you know, has this insidious plot to, you know, that's what's behind all of technology and a lot of like...
And probably Starbucks.
Development, yeah. And so, I really...
So are you going
to... No, don't just...
Well, I'm just trying to figure it out.
Okay? Are you going to start drinking Starbucks now?
No.
Okay, so one of the interviews, the interviewer asked them about Starbucking, like, what was that all about? And it actually came up while they were making the movie. It was an inside joke, so they put it in the movie. And they said, and here we are, all three of us are drinking Starbucks. Like, every one of them had a Starbucks coffee in their hand while they were talking about Starbucking.
Did they plan that?
Probably not, because they had to stop and get it before they came to the interview.
They needed coffee.
They were getting a check from Starbucks.
Coffee. Right.
It's like Fight Club, Planet Starbucks, and stuff like that. Yeah, talking about corporate...
I mean, it goes back to that they're able to be very playful but make very profound points at the same time. So I think that's one of the reasons people like them, is that they don't take themselves too seriously, but they're still pretty serious. I mean, if you look at the themes of their movie.
Chris still looks like he's thinking about it.
I mean, it's right there. You know, there's just so much. It's because I only saw the movie once.
So next time we're going to make sure you've seen something more than once.
At least.
No, yeah. We'll take care of that next time. We're going to do next time.
Right.
Well, I guess that's probably as good a point as any. It's not like we hit everything, because there's still like concepts of like the individual versus the collective and things like that we didn't even come close to touching on. But, you know, we're getting about that time. So it's that time in the show where we get to do our... Come on! Moments, which actually was very hard for me because I enjoyed this movie so much. Which may I'm going to make Chris do it first.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
So, Chris, what was your... Come on.
I already hit on it. Big time for me was the... I just couldn't follow the relationship well between, you know, in Shaun of the Dead, what I love so much of those two characters was really, in my mind, it was... seeing that the bromance happen, you know, like, like while he was pursuing this girl, like they had this like deep love for each other, you know, and I love that. And in Hot Fuzz, it was the same kind of thing, you know, like this bromance, and I just love it.
Jump through the air and fire.
It's so perfect, and I just don't feel like... maybe it's just because I can't wrap my head around it, but like the thing in the bar at the very end, and it just didn't tie up in a neat little package in my mind. And maybe that's what I feel this inner angst about, is like I want it to be a nice little package, but maybe that's just not the message the movie is trying to give, is, you know, maybe life isn't a neat little package. But for me, I was like, I wanted to see that happen, and it didn't happen, so...
It was, especially after the first two films, the shock of them not being, like, best buddies from the beginning.
And that, for me, it hurt my soul to see, to see Nick Frost not, like... At the beginning, I was very scared that he was going to be this stuck-up, like, tightwad. But then when he tossed those shots back, I was like, all right, he's back!
Shots!
Like, he can do funny drunk better than anybody can, and it's awesome. So,
I think your come-on moment just turned into, like, your happy moment.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very conflicted.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time coming up with a come-on moment as well, if I have one, which I really don't. But if I had to pick one, it would probably be that in this movie, I think the dialogue got closer to the line of being over the top about getting to the deeper meaning. This is something Chris and I were talking about. Like, it was just, it was laying it on heavy.
And all at once.
I mean, the end, like, I can't think of any other scene in any of the other movies where the climactic thing was just laying it out for you that blatantly. A couple lines that I wrote down. Gary King says to his friends, "You're just jealous, you're slaves to your houses, your wives, and your jobs, and I have freedom." And their response is, "We're not your friends, we're your enablers." And then just the whole thing back and forth about freedom versus being messed up and being perceived to be free versus being a robot and having a perceived happiness. So, I think they're such good writers that I don't think it hurt them. Like, I don't think anybody was rolling their eyes and saying, like you'd been brought along so well in the movie up to that point that you were all in emotionally. I think that's where movie makers get in trouble is when they try to do this big explanatory scene and they haven't invested you emotionally in the movie. You're just like, quit being my teacher and make a movie for me. Like, these guys made a serious movie. And so they earn the chops to do that final scene, I think.
Well, just to make sure that my wife's opinion is heard, because I care about that.
Right, it's important.
I mean, both of you are kind of hitting on things that she had a problem with, because I was telling her I was having trouble coming up with a come-on moment, which I think speaks a lot to the film, because when the writing's that good, it's hard to find, like, big gaping holes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she said everything at the end is kind of, like, it was two huge scenes that were very emotional.
Right
back, there wasn't any spacing between them. They weren't drawn out. There was, like, boom and boom, and it was almost too much.
You got to process there at the end.
So there is that, but it didn't bother me as much as it bothered her, but I think that's the remnants of that are in what y'all are saying. And the only thing when I left the theater that really didn't feel right to me was that I felt like the gather the troops kind of series of things, like the whole beginning of the movie, going to get everyone, it felt really rushed. Like, I didn't have a chance to really get to know the characters. And fortunately, I did later in the movie, not as much as I would like to, but it felt like they had to really get to the town really quick. So we didn't have a chance to get this stuff. But then at the same time, the best I can do to deconstruct that scene is the fact that it's still, they had to get 12 pubs. So you got a lot of movie to go.
Right.
So you kind of got to get on with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things, like I said, I wish they could have done, I wish the opening could have been a little more fluid. But at the same time, I realized that if you're not going to make this movie like 2.5 hours long, you got to get moving. Mm-hmm. So
I would say one of the things I love the most about Hot Fuzz, and I dearly love it, is that I feel like there's just so many little, not kind of like little Easter eggy type things, you know, like you watch it and you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't ever notice that before. And it's so funny. And perhaps it's because
you need to see it again.
Only watched it one time, but it still didn't seem like in Hot Fuzz to me, everything had more than one meaning. Mm-hmm. Everything.
No wasted characters.
No wasted words. No wasted, you know, visually. Everything had at least one, if not multiple, you know, it had many, many purposes and meanings and interpretations. And it's, and for me, that just is so brilliant. And I really love that about it. Just seemed like a really finely crafted movie. And in this one, I didn't sense that, yes, it is still there, but just not quite to the level that Hot Fuzz had it. And that's partly, I just think Hot Fuzz is a brilliant movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't, you know, it was really good, but, you know, just a smidge.
So now we're going to have to come back and have like an addendum to this episode of like, perhaps. Chris, you've now seen the movie a second time.
Wow, it's amazing. Yeah, you might be right. Yeah. You might be right.
Well, speaking of amazing, so we obviously take our next step. Favorite thing about this movie? I guess you went first last time, guys, Chris. So you can make Elijah go first this time, I guess.
Okay, you're going to make me go first. Man, that's hard too, because there was a lot there. I actually really like the soundtrack of this movie. I thought the sounds that they picked were very... set the scene well, and a lot of times the sounds, a lot of times the songs were just part of the dialogue. Like when they're riding in the car and they're singing, I'm free to do what I want any old time. Like they basically could have said that, but the song said it for them.
Yeah.
So I thought that was done very well. I think probably my favorite, if I had to pick one, I really like the beginning where it's kind of this flashback. It's retelling the story from their youth and this highlight of their kind of the greatest moment of their life, or at least Gary's life. And then it cuts back to the AA meeting, and it's him just telling the story to a bunch of people who are kind of drooling as he's telling it. And then the moderator says, okay, does anybody want to challenge Gary? It's like, and in some ways that kind of foreshadows his pub crawl with his friends, because they do, like, that AA meeting doesn't love him enough to challenge him, but his friends really do want to challenge him, and so some cool foreshadowing going on there.
I think for me, my favorite part or scene would have to be the bathroom scene. And I really wish I could have gone into the movie not knowing that aliens were a part of it, because, you know, that's part the of moment. The magic is, you know, like, this is completely absurd. And when you see these guys starting to take apart these little high school robot boys, you know, and it's actually some pretty cool, like, action and stuff.
It's good.
Like, and you see this big guy, like, doing some, and he, like, drop kicks or whatever.
Elbow drops
him. Elbow drops him. Oh, my gosh.
And I'd have to add a second one to that. Once you said that, it reminded me of the scene where he basically takes on the bar stools on his fists, like nunchucks. And I can't remember if it's that scene or another one, but they basically start playing the Matrix music from where they run through the lobby and doing these flips and all that stuff, shooting however many guns they're shooting. But just the fight. I do feel like the fight scenes in this movie were the most advanced fight scenes of any of the three movies.
So clearly, forget all the theology. Clearly, it boils down to the action.
Scenes.
Clearly, we know it's important.
Yes.
Well, I never really thought about it until you just said it, Chris. But like, I do wish that I didn't know there were aliens in it. Because I think one of my favorite parts of Hot Fuzz is the fact that I had no idea that they were all, you know, like the girl in the basket's going to have guns. You know, Sergeant Angel, surely you're a man of peace, you know, and pulls out the, it's great. Because you never saw it coming.
Right.
You know, it was the absurd that you never saw.
Right,
Unlike Shaun of the Dead, where we saw the zombies coming.
Yeah.
Let's see. So, my favorite moment isn't necessarily a moment, but it's a thing. And especially recently, I've realized that I am kind of growing tired. This makes me kind of snobbish. I'm really getting older. I'm really growing tired of kind of American comedy. Because I find that American comedy is going in more of like a shock comedy. And shock comedy doesn't do a whole lot for me. Like, we're going to do something outrageous. Like, because
dumbass,
yeah,
jackass, yeah,
or another end of the world movie, like This Is the End came out at the same time,
right?
And it's all very like crude humor, and it's not even that, you know, I don't have, obviously I would not suggest people go seek out crude humor, but like crude humor does not tend to affect me, but I, at the same time, I don't find it as funny as someone just writing things that are very, very clever.
Yeah.
And so the thing I love about this movie is that I had a lot of pushback from people who said, oh, that looks just like another, you know, stupid, crude comedy. I mean, like, Meet the Millers is making tons of money now. And it's just another crude American comedy. And I'm sure there are plenty of funny things in it. And I don't want to necessarily say that if you think it's funny that you're stupid or anything, which is why I'm saying I'm a snob. But like, this whole brand of like, I need to see it two or three or four times because it's so clever.
Yeah.
And like, I was just sitting there thinking about some of the lines that would make me giggle later.
Yeah.
You know? And I was just like, Gary King saying, "We're going to see this through to the bitter end or lager end."
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, that's clever.
Right.
Or Oliver's like, maybe they have selective memories. And Gary King's like, yeah, like, what's his name? Me! You know, and they have these running jokes that they go through. Or when he talks about, like, a lion eating hummus, you know. Or, you know, King Arthur coming back from battle and getting a tap water. Yeah, it just, I think when they come back from the, where do they come back from, I think, the outdoor fight with the twins, and I wish I would have wrote down the line, but he's like, can we all agree that we haven't come up with a better name than like something, 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 something? And it's just completely...
The band theme.
Yeah, and band so name. It's just ridiculous, and they keep having like the band names and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just, it's such a clever brand of humor that like I want to watch it over and over again, because like I said, I find that like in American kind of comedies, when it's shock comedy, watching it twice usually isn't as funny.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know it's coming. Right. You know, I know that someone's going to slap somebody in an awkward spot, or, oh, look, you got hit in the nuts again. You know, it was funny the first time because you didn't see it coming.
It is funny the first time.
It is funny the first time.
Yeah, but it's...
But, you know, right. It's not something I want to watch, like, over and over again, because right. It's... And this is what I talk about in the beginning, you know, it's... To a certain degree, they have almost redefined certain comedic genres by taking on these type of cinematic tropes. So that's just, like, my favorite stuff about it. Like,
right.
Shaun of the Dead, incredibly funny without being, like, outrageous. You know, Hot Fuzz, same thing. World's End lives up to the billing. So, so I can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sex in the movie except a dude's butt.
A dude's butt,
which Chris Elijah really liked. Apparently,
no, right? The characters really liked.
Oh, okay, yeah. I see.
The disabled. You forgot the disabled.
Oh yeah, that was one of my favorite lines. We'll always have the disabled. Yes, we'll always have the disabled. Which in and of itself, just like, you can't quote that line around other people and them have any clue.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much context to it. So that's great. But I really, really appreciate you guys joining me for this one. This was probably one of my favorite movies that I've seen this year. I'm glad you both enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
Like we do at the end of every show, I give our illustrious, you can't see the hand motion I'm doing, but it's an illustrious hand motion.
It is.
I give our illustrious guest a chance to kind of, I think I said pimp last time and Elijah had an objection to that. Kind of pimp yourself, but kind of promote yourself. So, Chris.
Can I choose to pimp myself instead?
You may choose to pimp yourself.
Okay.
You have to talk to your wife probably.
Yeah, but okay.
That's not going to. So, Chris, if people are interested in following you, getting in touch with you.
Yeah.
I guess pimping you.
Yeah.
Have we gone that we've got? We've already got digressed at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't clever funny anymore.
No.
you've just turned.
It's easier, isn't it?
I just turned American.
True human. You just criticized.
My Newcastle oral.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Gotcha.
So if people wanted to follow you or just, you know, have a conversation with you, how is there a way that they can do that? Or are you a hermit?
I'm a semi hermit. I mean, good luck if you want to follow me. I am on Facebook occasionally, but this whole Twitter thing and what?
You have an account?
I don't think I do anymore. Maybe I do.
You didn't delete it, did you?
Perhaps. So,
I think I'm still following you.
If you're looking for a challenge, try and follow me and see what happens.
What was your handle so they could try to follow you?
Yeah, on what?
On Twitter.
On Twitter?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Tell them where you like to play games.
I like to play games, as in board games.
Yeah.
Well, I like to play games at Geeksboro.
There you go, Geeksboro Coffee.
Yeah. I do like the Friday night game night there. I'm there semi-occasionally.
So if you're up for a challenge?
I'm somewhat of a ninja, you know, you can't tie me down.
You're like Shadu?
Yes. Oh, gosh. Right, yes. So good luck. Good luck, everybody, trying to follow me.
Chris, the unfindable.
The unfindable. I do work at Chick-fil-A, so come and get some chicken, and I'll
cook it.
Cook it. If you reference this podcast at Chick-fil-A, I will give you a water.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to go to Chick-fil-A now because I do like water.
And I might even put a lemon in it.
Who drinks tap water, though? It's like King Arthur coming back from the Crusade.
That's ridiculous.
Elijah Lovejoy, happy to be back here. I think this is my third podcast, so thank you, Mikey, for the invitation. I typically get either criticized or complimented alternately, depending on who's doing the talking for being a thinker or a deep thinker. So this kind of gives me a field to play in, I guess you could say, thinking about movies and film and theology and all that. I am the executive and community pastor at Church of the Redeemer. So you can come check out our website, redeemergso.org, or check us out at Burmill Clubhouse Park on North Battleground Avenue. And I think that's about it for me.
Once again, here in Greensboro. I mean, because we in the international.
We are in Greensboro, that's right.
Yes.
For all you watching or listening in Japan.
Yeah.
It's a flight, but it's worth it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So if you want to interact with me or let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on Twitter because I actually do I Twitter. You can follow me at Fizzification. Wow. Isn't that impressive?
Yeah.
You can also find us at our blog, realworldtheology.com. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you do find us on iTunes, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here, you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye.
Bye.